from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn how the Moms Mental Health Initiative is working to connect new parents with the right help. And the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors is about to vote on a funding plan for improvements to the Mitchell Park domes. We'll hear what's at stake.
It's been 35 years that we've been kicking this can down the road on fixing the domes. And the thing is that for me, the most important thing is that Mitchell Park is going to get investment.
Plus, we'll learn about a new album all about Wisconsin birds in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
I thought, what if a loon call went in there? What would that sound like? That made me to think, can I connect these things that I love, birding and music, and make it into a reflection of myself?
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Moms Mental Health Initiative was founded in 2016 by two local moms. Both women experienced postpartum depression and anxiety, but struggled to get help that was actually helpful and timely. There are many things that impede access to mental health care for new parents: a lack of insurance, stigma, and systemic disparities. One in five women struggle with maternal mental health conditions, but only a quarter of those women will get treatment. That number only increases for mothers of color. The Moms Mental Health Initiative is working to bridge the gap through peer-driven support, resource brokering, and advocacy. To share more about how MMHI is working to reshape mental health care access, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski speaks with Casey White, the organization's marketing and communications director. White begins by explaining the wide range of conditions that could impact perinatal people.
So there's a range of conditions that you can experience both in pregnancy and postpartum. And that is what perinatal means, is pregnancy through postpartum. And you can experience postpartum depression, perinatal depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, bipolar can come up in the postpartum period, and substance use disorder is one of the most severe and pervasive disorders that face perinatal people.
You mentioned the founders and many other people who have given birth have the challenge of really having difficulty finding help when you need it. And a lot of this has to do sometimes with systemic structures that exist in traditional medical landscapes that we have to navigate. Can you share how this limits access to care for moms and birthing people?
It is so extensive, so bear with me. There is an overall lack of access to mental health care. We have faced hundreds of years of stigma and shame around mental health, and so the conversation is pretty young, so that is already a barrier. When you talk about minority populations, communities of color, systemic racism is pervasive to the extent that if you walk into any traditional medical institution and you are a person of color, there's, as I've heard described to me, a feeling of, I am different and this is not made for me. So systemic racism creates a lot of anxiety and uncertainty, mistrust in certain communities that makes it harder for people to want to reach out and to ask for help. I think when we talk about birthing people, you know, women's health is understudied and underfunded. So that's also a piece of this as well. So not only may you be a woman walking into an underfunded and understudied experience in the perinatal period, but if you are a person of color, you're also going to experience perhaps racism or just an anxiety that you may experience racism or not get the care that you need or not be heard when you speak about a problem that you're experiencing or a concern that you have.
And I also want to note a Wisconsin problem. I know it exists elsewhere in the U.S., but in Wisconsin, Medicaid coverage also limits moms to 60 days only postpartum for care to be covered.
So I have to take a deep breath on this one because I get rather passionate when I speak about Medicaid in Wisconsin. So we are one of two states in the country that has not extended Medicaid past 60 days. many people don't even develop a perinatal mental health condition until after 60 days postpartum. 6 to 9 months is the highest risk time period for death related to mental health. So if you are someone who may not routinely qualify for Medicaid and you lose that coverage after 60 days and you still can't afford private health care, or if you can afford private health care, you can't afford co-pays or medications. If you're not able to access Medicaid, you may not get the care that you need after 60 days. And that puts a lot of people in the position of making a choice between caring for their mental health or putting food on the table for their children. It puts people in the position that they have to make a choice not to access the mental health care that they need to feel better and to be good parents and productive members of society. It goes so far beyond just your mental health as a person. It impacts us all and it benefits us all when we take care of people who are experiencing perinatal mental health conditions.
As we've been touching upon the reality of the barriers that systemic structures can place on birthing people, as you've said, this reality also contributes to significantly worse outcomes for birthing people of color who experience postpartum depression at twice the rate of their white counterparts. So you mentioned systemic racism, of course, but can you go into a bit more detail about the factors that result in such poor outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we talk about is it's important to recognize that all people have different experiences, right? So where you come from in your socioeconomic background, the things that you've experienced in your life, your level of education, your access to healthcare, your access to food, your family structure, the culture that you came from, all of these things impact how someone walks into an experience like giving birth. So, you know, someone may come from a community that doesn't like taking medications. They may be less likely to take a prescribed mental health medication. So what we try to emphasize in the healthcare community is treating people like people. Ask someone about where they came from. Ask someone about their family. Try to understand what barriers they may experience to getting the help or accepting help, or even what their life has given them in the way of risk factors, and address a person, treat a person for who they are in their life experiences.
Unfortunately, when people do navigate a healthcare system, sometimes we feel like we're not treated as a person. You know, sometimes an appointment might be 10 minutes or less after waiting for more than an hour. The whole person approach, unfortunately, is maybe a rarity. So how are the current systems that address perinatal mental health siloed, and what's the approach of the Moms Mental Health Initiative to try and change this?
There's no cohesive care for perinatal mental health. You can go to different places. You can be screened in different places. You may go to your OB. You may go to your primary care if you're struggling. Maybe you have a therapist or a psychiatrist, and those people are not going to talk to each other. Pediatricians also screen for the parent's mental health. Are they going to get you where you need to go? They're not going to prescribe for you. They're not going to get you to a therapist. So there are many different people that have an investment in perinatal mental health in our traditional healthcare system, but they're not talking to each other and they're not uniformly addressing perinatal mental health.
Now, with the Moms Mental Health Initiative and trying to address this, you have kind of three pillars to your approach. There's peer support, resource brokering, and information sharing. So would you mind just kind of helping break down those three aspects for us?
Yeah, so we're a bridge, not a destination. So everything that we do is about breaking down those silos and connecting people to the right help for them when they're struggling with their mental health. So resource brokering is connecting someone who's struggling with their perinatal mental health with a knowledgeable provider. That is someone who either has expertise or training in this very unique time period and the emotional journey that comes with it. We have vetted all of these providers to make sure that they do have that expertise or training. They've all agreed to make contact with someone within 48 hours or so, even if it is just to say, hey, my schedule's full, MMHI will be able to get you to someone who can help. Peer support is our bedrock program. So that's what everything is built on that we do. It's where Sarah and her co-founder, our executive director and her co-founder, started in a group that was for moms who have experienced this. And we're not clinicians. There's no white coats here. We are people who understand what it is like to go through one of these conditions. And every program includes a little bit of peer support. When we are doing resource brokering, we're answering as someone who's been there. I know that this feels so hard right now, but it will get better, is a big piece of our messaging. We have an online only unsearchable peer support group. We have in-person peer support groups, and we're really trying to build that up because people crave that connection. And it is a data-backed way to help people feel better and to help them stick to a treatment plan as well. So peer support is a big piece of what we do, and it's part of everything, including education and advocacy, which we do a lot of. And there's a grand scope of what we do. We have gone into healthcare systems and talked to all the OB nurses about what to do when someone is struggling with their mental health in their care. How do you connect someone to a resource? And it's all based on this perspective that we're not going to read out of a textbook to you. We're going to present to you what perinatal mental health conditions look like as a patient.
In the resource brokering component, you mentioned that you're screening and vetting providers. I'm hoping you can share a bit more about this process. Are providers reaching out to you interested in becoming part of this network as a point person to help connect patients to what they need? Are you also reaching out to people, making them more aware, and hopefully motivating a change in care and approach?
It is both. We have professionals who are reaching out to us asking to be part of our list. We also do reach out when we see, you know, a type of provider or a specialty that is needed on our list. We want to make sure that our list is reflective of the people that we're serving. So if we don't have a provider that comes from a specific culture or understands a certain experience, we are constantly seeking out new people to make sure that anyone who asks us for help can receive it.
Ideally, this also helps care be timely, right? Because the waiting period can also just make things a lot worse for the patients waiting for support. So with this in mind and the overall goal of reshaping mental health access, you know, it certainly doesn't happen quickly, but what are some resources people can start with today, either for care providers or those who are seeking it?
Perinatal mental health is always urgent. It's not always an emergency, but pregnancy only lasts 9 months. You only get 1 year where your child is considered an infant, and we truly believe that people deserve to feel better. They deserve to be the parent that they want to be. And when you're struggling with your mental health, that makes it so much more difficult, if not impossible. So for providers, we encourage them to either hold spots for perinatal people who are seeking treatment for their mental health, or get in contact with them, let them know that you'll be able to see them in a week. Additionally, you can always refer them to us or back to us, and we will find someone who can provide that. But, you know, the 6-month waiting list that our behavioral health systems have, it's just not going to work for perinatal people. Because if you realize you have a problem at 3 months, by the time that comes around, your baby's 9 months. You're probably back to work. You probably don't have time. And untreated perinatal mental health conditions can become an emergency pretty quickly. And for people who are struggling with their mental health as a perinatal person, you can call your doctor's office and tell them you feel that this is urgent. Request a call back right away. If that doesn't work, you can try another healthcare provider. So if you're talking to your primary, you can try your OB. You can ask your pediatrician for resources. And of course, Moms Mental Health Initiative is always here to help. So we do want people to advocate for themselves, but we know how hard that is when you're struggling with your perinatal mental health. And so that's really what Moms Mental Health Initiative is here for. If you feel like you're not getting the answers you want and need from your providers, please reach out to us, because we know we can get you connected to someone. We know that we can get you to someone who accepts your insurance or has a sliding scale, whatever you need. And we know that they will talk to you fairly quickly.
Well, Casey, I want to thank you so much for sharing more about the resources and the gaps you're trying to bridge when it comes to perinatal mental health.
thank you so much for talking about this very important topic.
Casey White is the Marketing and Communications Director and soon-to-be Associate Director of the Moms Mental Health Initiative. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow, the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors will vote on whether to fund construction of the reimagined Mitchell Park domes. The plan will use $30 million county dollars, along with over $80 million private and federal dollars, to fix and renovate the iconic domes facility and Mitchell Park. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez speaks with Domes visitors and Juan Miguel Martinez, the 12th District County Supervisor who has championed this project. But first, Jimmy speaks with Krista Beal Diefenbach, CEO of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance, which would take over operating the domes under the new funding plan. Diefenbach says when the domes opened in the 1960s, Milwaukee quickly fell in love with the beehive-shaped glass bubbles.
I mean, that's what they were actually described as at the time, these glorious glass bubbles, which were a willful act of hope. And if you think about that, this was a demonstration project. This was meant to be, we're in the middle of a industrial valley. You have these smokestacks that were just coming out everywhere. And then from that, these bubbles that burst into the air. And it just was, I think, this amazing opportunity for civic pride and to really lean into this idea of Milwaukee is a world-class city and therefore deserves to have a world-class conservatory.
Can I ask then, over the years, what happened to the domes?
Well, of course, we know this is a story of the fiscal challenges facing the county. There was no money for deferred maintenance. We lacked the amenities to create a sustainable business model. And so what I mean by that is that the county had to cover our deficit budget every year. And that went on year after year after year. And today that's over $1 million that they're covering. You know, if you think about needing to then put away for or use monies, you know, where there's so little available and this project became just very, very large and costly. And that deferred maintenance, that's what happens when you don't, you know, replace your windows in your house, then other things start to go wrong and bad. And then it becomes so costly that we're sitting with a capital project that is well outside of the reach of Milwaukee County. And that's really what happened. If you think about this, there was this like downward spiral. But I think the important thing that I'd like your listeners to know is that, yes, there is this idea of the domes being very challenged, and it's just this project is complex and it feels like a lot. But the reality is the domes are also in many ways this source of strength. You know, if you look at our last several years of operations, we arrested that downward spiral. So, you know, when I started 4 years ago, we had 1,800 members, and today we have over 5,000. We were serving a couple thousand children through our school field trip program. Today, we're well over 5,000. You know, our admissions was at 100,000, and, you know, now we're creeping up toward 300,000. I mean, that is a story of strength and a story of opportunity, but I think it's oftentimes not one that the community hears or understands.
What happens next?
We are heading into the vote from the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors on Thursday. So that will be their opportunity to, again, endorse this policy, which they had endorsed back in November of 2024. And that was to allow us to continue moving forward. That included a $30 million commitment from Milwaukee County, as well as the approval for us to go on the National Register of Historic Places. So we're working our way through that process. And then it also endorsed the idea of Milwaukee Domes Alliance taking over operations and transitioning into, you know, this new role. So when they vote on Thursday, what they're really voting for is the annual appropriation of $5 million, which, of course, is what we had requested as part of that $30 million. So it would be paid over 6 years, $5 million. This is, of course, conditional on us coming back to them with a development agreement and lease agreement. And we're working with donors who are interested in partnering with us and being part of the solution. I think that one of the really key parts of this project is that when you think of that capital stack, so for phase one, it's $115 million, and it does not fall unduly on any one entity. So we have Milwaukee County that's contributing $30 million. We're asking our philanthropic community to contribute $35 million. And those are dollars that will be matched by the county. So, you know, that was part of the agreement we made, is that up to $30 million, the county will match donations dollar for dollar. We're also leveraging tax credit financing. So that's going to bring in almost another $35 million. So you put all of that together, and we're able to create this capital stack that makes this project possible. And, you know, that's definitely part of the strength of this project, is our ability to leverage all of those different funding areas.
Are y'all going to the domes?
Bringing my granddaughter.
You bring your granddaughter?
Yes.
What's your granddaughter's name?
Weslyn.
Weslyn, are you excited to come to the domes today?
Yes.
Yeah. What are you hoping to see?
To see dinosaurs.
I haven't been up here since I was in grade school, so definitely intrigued by the experience to see kind of if I remember it how it was.
I love seeing all the flowers and plants that I can't see anywhere else.
I'm originally from India, and so I haven't been there in a while, but it's so nice to, like, you know, see some of the plants that I grew up with and right here in Milwaukee.
What does it mean to have a space like this that you can get to in Milwaukee that has, like, these three different ecosystems and kind of the horticulture available to you?
From some people's perception, they might not look at it as something that's enviable, but it really is, to be able to access something like this that's so readily available.
I think it's amazing how accessible it is. Right now we're here with family, but we were here as part of, like, a college outing. And I think it's just so nice to have something that's, like, accessible to every demographic. You can always go have a great time. So, yeah.
It's always been here. So it's just very important to be able to go places and take grandchildren and things that they can see and enjoy. That's really important. So this is important.
What do you think it would have meant to potentially lose a place like this?
Oh, we don't need to lose any more places like this. You know, Milwaukee doesn't have a lot of places that's inexpensive. So glad to stay. And so we're going to go on in right now.
My name is Juan Miguel Martinez. I am the county supervisor for the 12th District in Milwaukee. There's been a fight to save the domes for what I gather the last 35 years, since like 1990 or so. The thing is that the domes were built in 1964, and the original architect, his name is Donald Grebe, he said when he built them in 1964, these things have to either be torn down or completely replaced in 20 years, and that was 1984, the year I was born. So when I joined the board, I understood how important the domes are to the self-esteem of a neighborhood. Well, green spaces in general, being a socialist and a Milwaukee socialist at that, it's very important that I hearken back to the lessons that previous socialist leaders in Milwaukee have taught us. One of the biggest things that they did was establish the first park system and establish the first sewer system. And that's why they were called the sewer socialists. So it's very important that I maintain those lessons, especially when it comes to green spaces. A neighborhood is only as healthy as its green spaces.
I'm in the Heights neighborhood.
Yeah.
And moving over there, you know, we have Washington Park, which is this gorgeous space, which, if you're familiar with it, you know, that pool has sat vacant for a long time. Mm-hmm. The question that some supervisors have posed to you and residents have is, like, how does funding a project like the domes, what effect could that have on other parks?
No, that's a good question, and that's the right question here. Now, what's going on is that the plan entails the county giving the domes $5 million every budget season, which is the October of every year, for the next 6 years for it to fully realize its commitment. What that means is that a lot of other parks are going to have to forego capital improvement projects in their own parks. This is a very heavy lift and a very hard ask, and I do realize the reality of that. Everybody on the county board so far has been very supportive of this project because they understand what it means for the neighborhood, because it's not just about an improvement project for the park. it's an improvement project for the entire neighborhood and for one of the most blighted areas of the city. And I think it's very important that we do, that I do sympathize with everybody who would have to forego projects for the next 6 years. But trust me that I will, when I say that I will fight for things in the budget for their parks as well. But the thing is that it's been 35 years that we've been kicking this can down the road on fixing the domes. And the thing is that for me, the most important thing is that Mitchell Park is going to get investment. And Mitchell Park is what we need to fix. And this is going to have a ripple effect on Mitchell Park and the rest of the neighborhood.
That was 12th District Milwaukee County Supervisor Juan Miguel Martinez. He spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Before that, you heard Krista Beal Diefenbach, CEO of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up, we'll talk to a Madison-based musician about his new album, Inspired by Birds. But first, we're heading to the Fondy Farmers Market, Milwaukee's oldest farmers market. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Fondy Farmers Market is the oldest farmers market in the city of Milwaukee. For more than a century, it's brought produce and other goods fresh from the farms where they're grown. Today, the market has everything from fruits and vegetables to fresh juices and other health and wellness products. Venus Williams is the executive director of the Fondy Food Center, which runs the market. She's also our regular contributor for the series Dig In. I joined her at the market to learn more. We are here with the lovely Venus Williams. Venus, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for coming out to the Fondy Farmers Market here on a beautiful, humid July day as we are celebrating 107 years of this space.
107 years. That is such a long time for a farmer's market especially.
Yes, it has been in a few different locations. We've been here since 2020-ish. But indeed, by the time we hit a July morning, Saturday morning here in Milwaukee, this is one of the most vibrant places to be.
It really is kind of the peak of the growing season, it feels like. As you look around the market, there's so much abundance.
There is abundance, and yet we are not at our peak yet. I say we reach our peak when you see tomatoes and corn.
Okay.
So maybe another 2 weeks when the red tomatoes begin to show up and the corn is harvested. So we reach our peak at about the second week of August, and you come here and you buy way more than you will ever cook in a week, and you share it with your neighbors, but the fresh produce just brings you so much joy. And the people, the energy, the diversity, it's just an amazing place to be.
It is an incredibly diverse market. There is a lot of different produce to choose from, some that people might not be familiar with.
Exactly. A lot of the Asian greens, even when I come to one of the Hmong farmers and I ask, what is this? And they're like, I don't know the name of it in English. But that's part of the beauty of everything as well. So you come and you experiment, and fortunately in this day and age with all of our apps, you can take a picture and it can tell you what the green is, or you can just have some fun like we did a few weeks ago after we had a guest chef who made a 5-green gumbo with greens that he didn't necessarily know what they were, and it was so good, and I have done the same thing since then. So it's a place to learn, to explore, and to understand as well
that for a lot of people, things that they weed, like this purslane, even at Alice's Garden, we are harvesting purslane all the time. People look at this particular plant and they pull it up when it is tasty, it's high in nutrients, and in many cultures, it's something that you're going to stew up and add to some meat. For me, I, of course, just added to some of my other greens. Last week, I did it with a stir fry with yellow squash and zucchini and onions that I got from the market. So it's also understanding that things that we discard very often, like lamb's quarter, again, something else that we pull from our gardens and from the cracks of our cement, but the abundance of creation is there for a reason. We just no longer are connected enough to plants and soil and earth to understand it.
Looking at both lamb's quarters and purslane, these are things that I've seen in my garden. I'm going to guess a lot of people have seen in their gardens. And yeah, they weed them out because they think, oh, this is just something that flew in, not knowing how useful they can be.
Exactly. We think if we don't plant it, that it's not beneficial because we didn't make it appear. Well, guess what? Creation is more wise and abundant than we are. So it's a gift from creation. Learn what to do with it.
Very nice. What would you say are some of your favorite things about coming to the market, especially this time of year?
One of the things that I like has absolutely nothing to do with food, but with language. So when I'm walking through the market and I can hear 3, 4, 5 different languages being spoken, it brings tears to my eyes because it means that we are reaching deep into the city of Milwaukee to engage community related to food and in ways that are just so healthy and beneficial.
It feels like that's a real continuation, too, of Milwaukee's history. I'm sure 100 years ago the languages were different.
Exactly. So when you look at the history of the Fondy Farmers Market, and it was German, it was Norwegian, it was Italian, and in a document that we have that talks about the shift and the history of all of that, the Great Migration was the first shift when black folks left the South and went anywhere but South and landed in Milwaukee. That was really the first shift in the market here. And then now we have seen the Southeast Asian shift here in the city of Milwaukee and thus the market.
So if this is your first time coming to the Fondy Market, what is your big piece of advice for people when they come here?
It's like coming to a fresh produce maker's market mall. Do a complete walkthrough first. Come up to all of the vendor stalls. Come down the path and see what's available so you know what you want and what speaks to you. Also, engage the farmers. Ask the question, how do I prepare this? How do you cook this? What do you suggest I do with this? Whether you're talking about the fresh produce and even with the juices. We have two very engaging juice vendors, and the juices and the sea mosses that they blend are as healthy as the produce. So engage both Kamar and Candace and ask them about their juices. What are their benefits? When should I drink this? Tell me about the nutrients and all of the minerals within these juices.
That sounds exactly like how my husband goes to every farmer's market. Please tell me all this stuff.
Right. And as creators, right, as makers, as producers of these things, we love telling you about our product. So learn. Don't come here and think you're going to be in and out. Don't do an in and out. Linger. Have some lunch or breakfast. When we get finished here, I'm getting ready to have some salmon and grits for breakfast.
Very nice. Now, you are a voracious reader. Anyone who has been to your home will know this. What are you reading right now?
What I want to highlight today is actually a magazine, a journal, and that's Willow and Sage. So I have pulled out all of my past copies and recent issue of Willow and Sage. Willow and Sage is herbal-based. You know, it's about making soaps and creams and body oils, all of the things for our body. So I'm suggesting the quarterly journal, Willow and Sage, today. We want to keep magazines and journals going. Please pick up a copy of Willow and Sage. It delights your senses. The journal itself is such eye candy.
Very nice. Well, Venus, as always, thank you for joining us, and thank you for showing us around the market.
Thank you for coming out, and see you at the Fondy Farmers Market.
Venus Williams is the executive director of the Fondy Food Center and Alice's Garden Urban Farm. She's also our regular contributor for Dig In. You can find more of our conversations with Venus at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin musician and birder in our next episode of Chirp Chat. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Red-winged blackbirds, northern cardinals, and mourning doves are all birds you can commonly find in Wisconsin. They're also the titles of songs on Lifer, a new album by Madison-based band Quokka. Aaron Gritch is the lead singer, producer, and songwriter for the indie rock band. He says the new album combines his love for birding and music, while also telling stories through a bird's-eye view. Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez speaks with Gritch for this month's Chirp Chat.
For this episode of Chirp Chat, I thought it'd be great to highlight Quokka's new album titled Lifer, which is written entirely about Wisconsin birds. But before we dive in, I'd love to learn a little more about you as an artist. Who is Quokka?
So Quokka is a name that I started making music under probably about 6 or 7 years ago. Just the classic bedroom producer, Focusrite, Scarlett, and a Dream sort of thing. And it's just slowly morphed into what was just a hobby on the side to have a creative outlet for something, to dispel ideas and feelings into a band that's now playing around. And it's fun to see the evolution of just making little tracks in my bedroom that I didn't think anyone was ever going to listen to actually being able to get a group of people together and play out live.
So creating a project solely around birds isn't something you've done before. What inspired you to create this album, and why did you title it Lifer?
So I first got the idea for it, I think it was in twofold. A couple of years ago, I released my last album, Until the Tide Returns. And that was a pandemic album that was very much based, like every other pandemic album, around feelings of existentialism and dread. But I was thinking at the time that I was only really writing about myself and the things that I was feeling and those emotions. And I wanted to make something a little bit more unique than just the usual run of an album of whatever happens to be going on in a person's life at that point in time. I thought about what I could do to make it stand out a little bit more, to make it a little bit more unique and align it with the things that I love as well. And I was just making an instrumental one day, and I needed something before a progression change, just some sort of sound. And I thought, what if a loon call went in there? What would that sound like? And I put one in, and it sounded better than I thought it would. And that made me to think, can I connect these things that I love, birding and music, and make it into one product that is really a reflection of myself? It's both a deeper dive into that side of things, into the personal side of writing, but also something that's trying to capture interests of other people and feelings and experiences of other people as well. The name Lifer itself comes from the fact that I am a Wisconsin lifer, been here all my life, probably will be, and it's the name of the title that you get on the Merlin app when you see a new bird.
And I want to ask you a little bit more about that, the personal side of things. Like, what's your relationship to birds? Like, have you always admired them?
I was, like many other people, a pandemic birder. I got into it first because, like everybody else, you have a friend that says, hey, do you want to go outside and look at these? And the friend is actually the person who's done all my album art, a very talented watercolorist named Spencer Bierman. And his page, Birding for Your Convenience, first got me a little bit more interested, but started going out and going on more walks during that time and just getting out and trying to notice the world around me a little bit more, subvert my attention, try to pay more attention. That's really when it started to get to me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people could relate to your story, and I love the title, Lifer.
Thank you.
And I want to point out that in each track in the album, it's named after a bird that you commonly find in Wisconsin. Why did you decide to write about these specific birds?
I chose the birds for the songs in the album because I wanted the bird calls that are looped into every instrumental, I wanted them to be ones that were at least somewhat recognizable, like the robin and the loon and the cardinal, to try and have a little bit more relatability to it. As well, there were other things I wanted to fit in there, like the noble flamingo, the unofficial city bird of Madison, the name of the soccer team there, and also the flamingos that washed up on Lake Michigan a few years back. But a flamingo call was not something that I would call recognizable, so I tried to keep it to a frame of knowledge that would be accessible.
Yeah, I really love the intentionality behind that. As a listener, when I was listening to the album, I was like, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like, you're just going to play the bird call. But I never thought about the accessibility side of things. So with the album coming out soon, is there one track you're most excited for people to hear that we can listen to together?
Absolutely. I'd say that track is called Red Wing Blackbird. It was a single that we released before it that just has this great energy to it that we've been closing out all of our shows with, and that I'm really happy for people to hear.
All right, I'm excited. Let's listen.
Hey, can I get some space? I just want to crash on the couch now. It's been a hell of a day. I just wanna play out. I just wanna corner this world. Is that too much to ask? So I'll play my cards, and I hope they'll win. And I bet my house on just one trick. And it won't be
listen to Red Wing Blackbird by Quokka, and I'm Lake Effect's ex-grit Nunez speaking with Aaron Gritch, the lead singer, producer, and songwriter for the Madison Band. So something that I loved about this album is that each song is written through the perspective of the bird the track is named after. What was the songwriting process like for you?
Pretty much for all of them, it went in a similar direction, that I would start off with an instrumental that I found to be interesting, and then from there, just try to either fit in lyrics or see where the energy took me, see what kind of vibe I was getting from it, if it was something that was big and energetic and angry, or something that was a little bit more laid back, and just try to attach stories to it along the way.
And where were these like stories coming from? Like right now we've listened to Red Wing Blackbird. How did you know what to write for that bird's perspective? I think one of the lyrics is like crashing on the couch, like Red Wing Blackbirds aren't crashing on the couch. So can you explain that?
That and a lot of the other lyrics were trying to make bridges and parallels just between the different experiences that we share with other living things in the world. I love a red-winged blackbird. It's my favorite bird because for me it marks when spring, warm spring at least, starts to really kick in. But I know that it's not the most loved bird. It's kind of a jerk, I'll admit it. It's known for swooping at people and trying vigorously to protect whatever nest it may be in. And just thinking as a person growing up in this world and trying to find somewhere that you can call your own, that you can carve out for yourself, is a difficult process as well. And so I have a little bit more empathy now when I'm walking down the street and I hear a bird start to swoop at my head, just knowing that they're looking for a lot of the same things that we are.
I love that. And yeah, you know, you got to fend for yourself. And I think of like the bad rep that maybe brown-headed cowbirds get too, right? So how long did it take for you to write, record, and produce this album?
Way too long. Oh my God. Probably over the span of about a year and a half to 2 years, although an instrumental or two along the way is a little bit older than that even. The writing part was not the most difficult part. Spent a long time in the mix trying to get things right, but songs just kind of kept coming here and there. It was supposed to be a little six-song EP. Then I had another idea and it became seven, then it became eight, then it became nine, then it became 10. And I said, okay, whatever, I guess I'll do another album. So it was just letting those find me and allowing the process to be a little bit more drawn out to be able to encapsulate a full record.
And, you know, not everyone who learns about this album will be a birder. So what do you hope people take away from listening to Life, or why should they tune in?
I would say the thing that I would want is just for people to listen. For one, to the album, because I like that. But for two, just in your everyday lives, as you're walking down the street, hearing something that you may recall then from listening to the project, remembering to take moments out to realize that the cacophony that you hear is a bunch of various different birds and different calls and different songs, all with their own little lives that they're living. My one dream would be that if there's just like one person that listens to it and listens to the same song enough times to recognize that when they're walking down the street, they will say like, oh, hey, I know, that's a cardinal. That makes it all worth it.
That's amazing. And that's like honestly one of the best feelings, birding by ear. Well, Aaron, before we wrap up, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. So I'm wondering, what's a bird you'd like to highlight this month?
So this month, I might just keep piling it on if nobody said red-winged blackbird already.
No one has.
I just love the little guys, and it's at that time of the year where I start to get a little bit annoyed with them. Like I mentioned, I love seeing them in early spring, but not so much now when they're doing their thing. So I'm going to give them this month to remember the good times with them when I was happier to see them.
Can you describe the bird for our listeners?
So it is a black bird with a red wing that is most commonly found near water. And they nest quite a lot with quite a lot of other birds, and they're very territorial about those nests. So when people are walking around during nesting season, if anyone, any shape or size, person, dog, mail carrier, whatever, gets nearby, they're going to let you know about it. They might swoop at you. They might hit you. They might just yell. But they're a wonderfully, I think, a little bit misunderstood bird.
And I would agree with that. Well, Aaron, thanks so much for speaking with me today. It was really fun to learn about your new album, and I'm really excited for people to hear it.
Thank you. I'm really excited for people to hear it, too. More than anything, I'm just happy to see birding become more and more mainstream with things like this, people like Christian Cooper and Dexter Patterson. It's beautiful to see more people get involved in it. So I'll play my cards,
and I hope that Aaron Gritch is the songwriter, producer, and lead singer for the Madison-based band Quokka. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. Quokka's new album, Lifer, comes out this Friday. You can also see the band perform their new album on August 28th at the High Noon Saloon in Madison. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. A Bubbler Talk question asker wanted to know about a military plane crash that happened on Jones Island in the 1950s. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how it's connected to the Blue Angels in a new Bubbler Talk. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Don't ask me to work on the weekend.